Word today is from 1 Samuel chapter 31. That's 1 Samuel chapter 31. Now the Philistines were fighting against Israel, and men of Israel fled before the Philistines and fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was badly wounded by the archers. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor-bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. Thus Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor-bearer, and all his men, on the same day together. And when the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley, and those beyond the Jordan, saw that the men of Israel had fled, and that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled, and the Philistines came and lived in them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. So they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shan, and they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God.
All right. And so we come to the end of 1 Samuel and the end of the Saul storyline that we've been following here for a little while. Actually, here towards the end of the book, we've been kind of following two trajectories, two storylines, Saul and David. Today we bring Saul's storyline to a close, and then we'll actually do one sermon out of 2 Samuel 7, just to kind of put a nice little bow on the David story as well, too. So again, today we're looking at the end of Saul. It's kind of like a review, really, of Saul's life in his book, really this whole book. And as I was thinking about this week, you know, you can look at this Saul death from a couple different angles. You could look at this as finally the demise of the great villain of the book of 1 Samuel. Or you could look at it more with somberness, as I often find myself doing, because for me, Saul is perhaps the most human character in the whole book. And for me, Saul, he feels vaguely familiar. And so it's very somber, this closing scene. Actually, though, today, I think there's a really rich warning or admonition, I think, for our graduates here this morning in this passage. As I was thinking about our graduates this week and praying for them, and as I was thinking about this passage, praying over this passage, I feel like God kind of put the two things together. And so I just kind of want to look at this passage through the lens of presenting a pretty strong encouragement, warning, challenge, or admonition to graduates. And to start off with that, I thought I would quote from perhaps one of the most famous graduate speeches of recent years. It was 2005, and Steve Jobs, the Apple guy, the iPhone, iPod, all that stuff, he was doing the graduation speech at Stanford University out in California. So not a high school graduation, mind you, but a college graduation, and it's perhaps become one of the more quoted graduation speeches in recent history, and perhaps the most famous part about it was where he said to the graduates, this was, I think, a year after he found out he had cancer. I don't know if it was terminal quite at that point. But he says, look, your time is limited, so don't waste it living someone else's life. He goes on to say, don't let the noise of others' opinions drown out your own inner voice. And he says, and most important, have the courage to follow your heart and your intuition. They somehow already know what you want to become. Everything else is secondary. You've got to find what you love. And so it's been a little while since I've been to high school graduations. When I was a youth pastor, I used to go quite a bit. And it seemed like, you know, a lot of the speeches at these high school graduations were in some way, shape, or form a variation of that address. That look, life is short. So don't waste it on things you don't love. Do what you love. Find your heart's passion and go at it with everything. Don't let other people define who you are. Don't let other people tell you what to be. But listen to your heart. Find your passions and go hard after it. Do what you love. And so, I don't know. I don't know if there's anything more dumb that you could say to a bunch of high school graduates. Sorry. I don't know if there's anything more anxiety-inducing or oppressive, maybe. It's terribly elitist, actually. It's terribly privileged. Two-thirds of the world, more than two-thirds of the world, doesn't have the luxury to go out and find their passions and just live out. They just got to do whatever pays the bills. But also, it's just terribly sad as well, too. And I know that maybe sounds arrogant or prideful or a little overly harsh. And so I guess part of my intention this morning is to show you that I think the Bible would back that up. And the Bible would say, yeah, actually, that's the dumbest thing you could do. And I want to look at Saul and this closing scene of Saul's life as sort of a window into that biblical perspective. Okay, so that's sort of where we're going this morning. If you don't take anything else from the sermon, you could say the one point is this. Don't waste your life searching your heart, finding your passions. There's actually a much better way, much simpler way, too, to go at life. So let's talk about this. And see, here's the thing. As I'm looking at this Saul, this closing scene, like I could imagine that you could legitimately look at the death of Saul you could interpret the death of Saul in two different ways. Like, think about this. I could totally imagine, right, as these guys from Jabesh Gilead, they go and they pull Saul's body off the wall of Bashan and they bring it back to Jabesh and they burn it and bury the bones and whatnot. I could imagine them getting together and having a little memorial service for Saul right there. And maybe they all come and they sing a little song, they sing Saul's favorite hymn. And then, you know, I could easily see a couple of people starting to come up and, you know, and to speak and to give stories and testimonies. And I don't know, maybe his dad's still alive. I don't know if his dad's still alive. Maybe he comes up and, you know, with tears in his eyes, says, man, Saul, he was a great kid. You know, when he was well along in years and he was tall and he was handsome, he had the whole world at his fingertips. Yet he chose to care for me and stay and work on my farm and look after my sheep. He was such a good boy. He did it all the way until God called him otherwise. Or maybe somebody from Jabesh Gilead would get up and say, yeah, you know what? There was that time when Nahash, the Ammonite, was coming and conquering us and making a treaty with us. And you remember he said, well, yeah, you got to sign this treaty. And as whatever, I'm going to cut one of your eyes out as well, too. But Saul came with his men and he delivered us. Or maybe somebody would come up then and say, yeah, and you know this Saul, he was such a passionate man. And man, he built this kingdom. I mean, before Saul came, we were just this loose federation of tribes, everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. But Saul came, and out of his passion, he built a kingdom. And he was relentless and tireless, and he worked hard day and night to maintain this kingdom. He was fierce in how he maintained and built this kingdom. Maybe his sons. Well, actually, he only has one son left, Mephibosheth. Maybe Mephibosheth comes up and he says, you know, and Saul, he was a great dad. I mean, like any dad, he had his issues, he had his temper, he had, you know, he could go off the handle a little bit, but at the end of the day, he only wanted the best for us boys. He wanted to be able to pass the kingdom along to us. He wanted to make a name for us. He was the greatest daddy. And he worked it nonstop to preserve this kingdom for us. And maybe even somebody else comes up and says, you know what? And Saul was so valiant, so prideful, that even in the very end, rather than let the Philistines come and do shameful things to him and his body as the king or whatever, he valiantly fell on his own sword. Saul, valiant in life, tireless, passionate, and valiant in death. Right? Could you not see that? Certainly in today's culture, in today's world, if we were to bury Saul, could you not see that take place and those conversations happen? See, but of course the thing is, for those of us who've been following Saul from the biblical storyline, and as we look at this closing scene, we say you could scarcely imagine anything more tragic, anything more sad, anything more dehumanizing than what's taking place here in this scene. I mean, there's just sadness and tragedy written all over 1 Samuel 31. It starts in the very beginning where it says, you know, the Philistines were fighting against Israel. That statement right there is a statement of abject failure of Saul and his kingdom. I mean, think about it. Again, we're kind of reviewing the whole book today, but go back to chapter 9 when God says to Samuel, Samuel, I got a king for you. I want you to anoint him on my behalf. Why? Because I have heard the cries of my people and I want to deliver them from the Philistines. That was the whole point of Saul. That was the whole point of Saul's kingdom, was that God was going to deliver his people from their enemies. And had Saul been faithful and obedient, waiting on God, that's what would have happened. So it's a mark of abject failure here that at the end of the book, those nagging Philistines are still raging against God's people. And they're having the way with God's people as well, too. The men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and whoever didn't fled fell on Mount Gilboa. Not only is this, you know, his men falling or fleeing, but his own sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, lie dead there on the battlefield. Right, so here Saul, you know, there's just the sadness of it. The Philistines are raging. The Philistines are every bit as strong as seemingly as they were in the whole beginning of his kingdom. His armies are being eradicated. They're fleeing. They're falling on Mount Gilboa. And his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, Malchishua, lying dead on the battlefield. And then, you know, as I read through the storyline, it's almost like through 1 Samuel, it's almost like things get eerily quiet at this point. You know, he gets shot by this wayward arrow. But, like, I don't even know where it comes from because the Philistines aren't too nearby because they don't even see him fall. They don't even see his body laying dead until the next day. So I almost sense this eerie quietness. His people are fleeing. The kingdom is slipping out of his grasp. Boom, boom, boom. There go his sons fallen dead. And then in the quietness of it, perhaps Saul recognizes this is it. And perhaps Saul understands now this is how it's going to go. This is what Samuel said was going to happen, you know, a day ago in that weird scene from 1 Samuel 28. And sure enough, here it is. My sons have fallen, and I'm sure to fall next. I've got this mortal wound going here. And so he, you know, he knows what the Philistines are going to do to him if they catch him. And so he wants none of that. And so he tells his armor bearer, run me through. Let's put an end to this here and now. And his armor bearer says, no, thank you. It might have been fear. It might have been respect. I don't know. But here it is at the very end. And there is literally nobody left to obey Saul and to follow Saul. And so Saul grabs his own sword. And he shoves it in the ground. There's kind of like a poetic irony here in this passage. You remember from the beginning of the book, the prayer in the Song of Hannah, where she said, God is doing this different thing in Israel. The mighty and the prideful and the arrogant are going to fall, and he's going to lift the poor and the needy and the humble up from the ash heap and sit them on seats as princes. And then the last line is so important for the whole book. It says, for not by might shall a man prevail. And by this point in the story, Saul has said, yep, whatever. Spoken like a true woman. You know? No, of course it's by might. It's going to be my might. It's going to be by my sword and by my shield. I will prevail. And so there's sort of a poetic irony here that at the end, this guy who lived by the sword literally takes his sword, jams it into the ground, holds it up to his gut or whatever, falls on it, bleeds out, and dies. And of course, the shame and the sadness, it doesn't stop there. It keeps rippling out when the Israelites notice that Saul is dead and the army has been eradicated or fled off. They have to leave their cities, and so the Philistines are moving in now and taking over this city and that city and this tribe and this village. And it looks like at the end of the story, the Philistines have more ground, more land than they did at the beginning. Certainly the Philistine story is coming. David is waiting in the wings, but we're not there right now. Just see it for what it is now. And then perhaps the saddest part of the whole thing, right? The Philistines, they finally come the next day. They find Saul. They find his body. They alleviate him of his head. And they go carrying it out around like they did with Goliath back in the day. And then they take his body and they fasten it to the wall of Bashan. And then they take his armor, his sword, his shield. And notice what, did you pick it up, what they went around saying? Where is it? Verse 9. They sent messengers throughout the land of Philistines to carry the good news, the gospel, to the house of their idols and to their people. And they put his armor in the temple of Ashtaroth. Which, and you remember from way back when they did that with the ark, you know, what's going on there? Why do they take the armor and they put it in the trophy case of their gods? Because what in their minds, what has just happened? Their god has won, right? This cheap nut fertility goddess, Ashtaroth, has beaten the living God. And so let's go out through all the land and declare the good news, the gospel, that Saul is dead and our God, Ashtaroth, has beaten the God of the Israelites. I mean, can you get anything more sad and more shameful? In his life, he rejected God, and in his death, he puts God to public shame, public humiliation. Right, again, you just take the bird's eye view, and you look at this scene, and it is just a, you know, with Saul at the center, it is just this ripple out effect of sadness and tragedy. His army is decimated. His sons lie dead. The kingdom is fading out of his hands. Philistines are taking more and more territory. And God's glory is tarnished. His reputation is shamed in his life and in his death. And perhaps what's maybe most tragic about it is that Saul has so much potential. Right? When we first met Saul, again, he was a good son. He was sticking with his father. He was caring for his farm. He was looking after his sheep. And early on, Saul seemed humble. He gave God the praise and the glory for the victory, like when he defeated Nahash and the Ammonites. See, and then the warning is something switched in Saul. Maybe as the praises and the affirmation of the people started to rise. And, oh, Saul, you're so great, and you do this and you do that. Now there's something starts to switch in Saul's heart, and he starts to fall in love with that praise and that affirmation. And as his heart finds this new love, well, now it starts to direct his life. And his life becomes about appeasing the crowds and earning that praise and maintaining that praise. And when other people seem to garner more praise than him, well, now he gets bitter and a little upset. Saul's heart also fell in love with something that didn't belong to him. Saul's heart fell in love with this kingdom that wasn't his. Somewhere along the lines, his heart stopped loving so much the king himself, the giver of the kingdom, and started to love the kingdom that he'd been trusted with. His heart started to love this kingdom that was being built, this kingdom that God was building through him and entrusting to him as a steward. Well, Saul fell in love with the kingdom itself, and he took pride in what was being built, and he worked tirelessly and hard to hold on to that and maintain that. He became fierce in holding on to power that he had. And when any of that was threatened, what happened? He became fearful. He became anxious. He became violent. He became psychotic and vengeful. The other bit of poetic irony in this passage is that they bury him under a tamarisk tree. Saul and his tamarisk tree. You remember the last time we saw Saul under a tamarisk tree? Anybody? Come on, Ray. Huh? No, he wasn't hiding. They might have also at some point. It's at Nob, on top of the hill in Nob. He's sitting under a tamarisk tree, holding court, as it were. And it's at this moment where he's having literally a psychotic meltdown. He is convinced that David is out to kill him. Not true. And he's convinced that his son Jonathan is plotting with David to, I don't know, orchestrate his demise. Not true. And all his men are gathered around there, and he's convinced that all of his men are plotting and conspiring with Jonathan, who's conspiring with David, because they haven't told him about Jonathan's plan to conspire with David. Again, not true, not true. But he's getting all worked up, and then here comes Doeg, the Edomite, who says, hey, I'll tell you somebody who worked against you. I saw Ahimelech, the priest, go and pray for David. And so Saul, in his psychotic rage, he puts Ahimelech to the sword and then goes throughout the town of Nob and kills every single priest he can get his hand on. Right? So again, there's this sort of just poetic irony. I don't know if the folks in Jabesh Gilead knew that scene or not, but here it is. We're going to bury him under a tamarisk tree. His armor, his sword, what he lived by is literally what kills him and is hanging off in the trophy case of Ashtaroth. And here we bury him under this symbol of what his heart and his passions did to him. See, in other words, here's the thing. Saul is perhaps a perfect testimony to this truth of the scriptures. That look, the scriptures say, hey, look, there is this brokenness in the world. Okay, that's why Jesus has come. Jesus has come to deal with this brokenness that has invaded his creation. It causes us grief, it causes us to groan, it causes us hardship. And here's the thing, that brokenness is not just out there, but it's in here as well too. Right? It's the prophet Jeremiah, as he's surveying what's about to happen to the people of Israel. He says, you know, at the end of the day, well, it's God who says, the heart is deceitful, and deceitful above all things, and desperately sick. It's broken. Or it's Jesus when he's talking to the crowds and they're talking about things that come out of the mouth and sometimes anger and bitterness. And he says, hey, and remember, guys, it's not what comes out of the mouth so much that is the problem. It's what comes out of the heart. Because really what comes out of the mouth is just the overflow of the heart. It's the heart that has these seeds of violence and anger and bitterness. It's the heart out of the heart that comes evil thoughts, that comes adultery and sexual immorality. It's out of the hearts that come theft, slander, false accusation. Or it was the Apostle Paul, his letter to the Romans, who starts off by saying, you know, here's the condition of humanity, that though in the back of their mind they know God, they know who he is, and they know what he wants, yet they trade the glory of God for these other cheap knockoff gods. And in so doing, their thinking becomes futile, and their foolish hearts are darkened. Right? In other words, do you see the sort of the point here? Saul is this living demonstration of this biblical idea that would essentially be, why in the world would you follow your heart? I think I've confessed to you before that I'm a terrible person to follow on the road. Amy hates it when she has to follow me because I don't do a good job of keeping tabs in the mirror of where she is. And, you know, I maybe go through a yellow light, or sometimes I don't necessarily even know where I'm going. And so I have to, you know, pull into a parking lot so I can turn around, and if she's not behind me. So she's come to say it's much better if my phone is charged and I follow Lady Google instead of me. And I think the Bible would say in a similar way, like, why in the world would you follow your heart? Your heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. It's out of the overflow of the heart that comes immorality and evil and violence and theft. Or it's Paul saying your heart is darkened. It needs renewed. Or, you know, the Bible would say, why in the world do you go about following your passions? I mean, if anybody was a passionate man, Saul was a passionate man. When his honor was at stake, boy, he came passionate. And when his kingdom was at stake, well, you saw his passion in full fury. And, well, here it is. Here's where Saul winds up following his passions. In other words, here's the simple point. I think the biblical picture is, why in the world would you waste your life following your heart, searching after your passions? And, you know, here's the thing, too. Let me say this. Whatever, that speech was 2005, 15-ish, 16 years ago. Since then, interestingly enough, there have been a good number of even secular voices that said, yeah, you know what, I'm not so sure about that advice that Steve Jobs gave. I was listening to one woman the other day doing a TED Talk, not a Christian by any stretch of the means, and she actually quoted that graduation speech, and she said, you know what, that actually puts a whole ton of pressure on a person. It's actually harder than you think, if not even the hardest thing to do, to try to understand your heart, because your heart is malleable, your heart changes, dare we say your heart is fickle at times. So try to understand your heart and to do what your passion, find your passion, that puts a lot of pressure on a young person. Or she was saying, as she felt that pressure, it almost caused her to have a nervous breakdown. Or there are some studies out there that did research even in that Southern California area, and said, you know what? We're actually finding that advice, follow your passions, do what you love to do, it actually sets people up for failure. And that actually the key to success is more not doing what you're passionate about and what you love, but actually doing what you're good at. And as you give your life to that over time, your passions, that starts to cultivate passion in you, right? That's... You know what? Here's the thing. You live your life exclusively in pursuit of your passions. I guess I've offended him. I'm sorry. You live your life in pursuit of your passions, and you'll leave a wake of trail of destruction. There it is, in your wake. And some of them will even look at Steve Jobs' life and see some of the broken relationships he had in his workplace. It led him to be fired from Apple even at one point. Or they'll look at his family and some of the estrangement that he experienced with his children because he was so caught up in his own passions. So, which is all to say, you can find a whole lot of increasing secular advice saying, I don't know if I would follow that. I've yet to find a suitable alternative in that secular advice. Which is why I think the Bible's take is so powerful, so rich, and yet so very simple. I think the Bible would offer to you this. It would say, hey, don't waste your life following your heart, living your passions, doing what you love, but instead, train your heart to love the one you should be doing it for. Again, don't waste your life trying to understand your heart, trying to follow your heart, trying to pursue your passions and do what you love. Instead, train your heart to love the one you should be doing it for. So just real quick, maybe you would say, well, how in the world do I do that? Because you just got done telling me, or Jeremiah tells me, the heart is deceitful above all things, desperately sick. So how in the world do I train this beast of a heart? And here the Bible, again, would just give you two simple, very simple ways to do that. One, it would say, do the very thing that we're doing here. Where we're coming together and we're remembering, where we're singing, where we're praying, and we're declaring to one another this fundamental truth, this foundational truth, that first and foremost, above all else, remember that you are deeply loved by your Creator, by your Maker. Remember that while you were yet enemies of God, in all of your sin and all your rebellion and all your traitorous activity, while you were going around chasing your passions, living after your idols or whatever, God demonstrates his love for us in this, that Christ dies for us. He dies for us so he could carry the weight of our sinfulness, so that he could carry and ultimately assume in his life and his death the consequences of that, so that you could be forgiven, so that your slate could be wiped clean, so that you could be dressed in his glorious radiant robes of righteousness and be gathered into his people and given all the incredible promises of heirs with Christ. And you know, as you really start to think about that on a daily basis, and you remember that, and you look to this Jesus who has done all this, you start to find some of your affections of your heart beginning to change a little bit. It's like the Apostle Paul who says in 2 Corinthians 5, look, the love of Christ, it compels us. The love of Christ is so compelling. It compels us because we're convinced of this, that one died for all, and he died for those. He died for them so that they might no longer live for themselves, but for him who died for I can't tell if that's Jeffrey or, because that sounds very familiar. That's why I'm chuckling. So do what we're doing here. Stop and remember. The first and foremost, you want to train your heart to love. Remember that you are deeply loved, sacrificially loved, painfully loved. And you see that start to change your affections. The second thing would just simply to be to rest in the power of God, to do that work in your own heart. Right? Again, listen to Hannah saying, it's not by might that a man prevails. It's not by might that you tame the restless heart even. But it's the Spirit of God, the Spirit of Christ, the power of God at work that will change and renew and restore. And so you rest in that. It's really not all that complicated. It's really not all that hard and stressful. It's simply as you look to Jesus who has loved you so perfectly, so magnificently, and you look to his Spirit who has promised to finish what he has started in your life. And again, as you do that, you start to find your the loves of your heart start to shift and change, and your passions and your affections develop. And here's the last thing I would say. You do all of that not at the expense of passion. It's not that you are trading passion to all of a sudden love Jesus and to rest in him to accomplish this work in your heart. No, actually what you find is that as you train your heart by the Spirit's help to love Jesus, you become all the more passionate about a whole variety of things. You'll find yourself becoming more passionate about other people. You'll find yourself becoming more passionate about being at work in his creation, right? Because as you're no longer just working for the accomplishment of whatever your hands can do, but as you're working to bring honor and glory to the one who made you and who has loved you so tremendously, you find yourself really passionate to go at work, even no matter what it is. That's why Paul can write to pagan slaves, not pagan slaves, slaves. He can write to the slaves even, hey, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, you work or toil, whatever it is, do it all for the glory of God. And there's where you'll find your passion. Whereas you train your heart to love the one you do it for, you'll find yourself becoming passionate about the kingdom. Passionate to see other people find the freedom that comes from the love of Christ. Passionate to find other people see through your life the glory and the beauty of Christ. So again, hear me out. It's not to say you trade passion for the life that Jesus is calling you to. No, as you train your heart to love your Maker, to love the one who died for you, to love the Spirit that empowers you, you'll find that passion brewing. And then, as you follow your passions, then as you cultivate your passion for other people, and you cultivate your passion for Christ and his glory, and you cultivate your passion for his kingdom, well, you will find all these things will be added to you. Or you will find, as you delight yourself in the Lord, he will give you the desires of your heart. In other words, he will give you himself. I close with this. I don't remember too many of my own graduation speech. I don't remember any of them. I don't remember who. I remember the people who gave some of my high school graduation, but I don't remember what in the world they said. I remember who it was. I think it was Chuck Colson who gave my graduation speech. I don't know what. I couldn't tell you what in the world he said. I don't really remember too many speeches or addresses from my college or high school days. The one I do remember, though, is the one that was given. I was a music major. I told you that in the conservatory there. And the year before I graduated, the dean of the conservatory was retiring. 80-some-odd years old, old guy, white hair, very wise, very gentle and soft and spoken. Actually, he gave the speech on a hot May day in the middle of the afternoon, so I was fighting to stay awake. So I probably don't even really remember what a whole ton of his hour-long address to us, his closing address to us was. Other than this, I remember him over and over and over simply saying this to us as his charge: love Jesus. He would go off and he would talk about a variety of things. And then he would just come back to, and here it is, love Jesus. And it'll all fall into place. And then he'd go off and he'd talk about a few other things or whatever. And then he would just circle back around. And before he got off the podium for the last time and moved to Wisconsin or wherever he went, his final charge was simply this, love Jesus. And the rest will take care of itself. And that has stuck with me and has been some of this, the simplest and yet the most profound advice I've been given. And so again, I'd say to you graduates who are perhaps being inundated with this philosophy of life is short, do what you love to do, pursue your passions, understand your heart. There's a certain road that all leads you down. The Bible would say much simpler, train your heart to love the one you do life for. Love Jesus. And all of these things will then be added to you. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.